On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, it's beef time. We got benches clearing in Boston. We got Josh Naylor and Austin Hedges saying mean things to one another. And then we will preview the 2026 MLB draft, laugh about the Yankees' June swoon, and talk about LeBron James's big taste. If you know, you know. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world sick and tired of all these LeBron James rumors. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And what we really need to talk about is, where is Big Taste going to end his career?
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. What a throwback. Did we do a video? Did we do like 30 minutes on a podcast about Big Taste? I don't even remember what year that was. But I am so excited to go back and watch that as soon as we're done recording this podcast. Thank you, Jake.
For those of you not in the know, there is a LeBron James baseball soda commercial, no free ads, in which LeBron plays a closer named Big Taste, who comes in from the bullpen and throws an icy cold soda can by a hitter for strike three. And he's only referred to as Big Taste in the video. Just Google LeBron James, Big Taste. It is well worth your time.
You know what? I'm seeing just a quick Google is telling me that this was January of 2018, which was famously a down period for our podcasting career. And so I think by the time we record on Friday, I think there's a good chance that we will know where LeBron James is going. And maybe we revisit Big Taste for UGLA. I think that would be a really fun tribute to a really good basketball player. But this is a baseball podcast, and we have baseball things to talk about on this Wednesday. And so that concludes our LeBron James references today, as we will move to our opener today, which is beef.
Nothing like a little beef to soothe the soul. I would say that all things considered, this has been a relatively beefless season so far. We have not had many contentious fracases on our baseball diamonds across this wonderful country, but the last couple days have brought us some very spicy beef. Pour that bottle of sriracha onto your flank steak. Let's dig in. Wilson Contreras last night versus the entire Washington Nationals is, of course, the first topic. We will get to Josh Naylor versus Austin Hedges in the Guardian versus Guardian showdown that we had in Cleveland over the weekend. But Contreras is where we must begin. Last night, Tuesday night at Fenway Park, Wilson Contreras strikes out facing Cade Cavalli, a pitcher for the Washington Nationals. Pitcher who's very good, by the way. After the strikeout, Cade Cavalli chirps something at Wilson Contreras. We'll sprinkle in the specifics as we go. Chirps something at Wilson Contreras. The two start jawing at one another. Bench is clear. And for like 3 seconds, it seems as if it's going to be your normal chest rubbing, name calling, let me at him jamboree. And then Contreras sees red, charges at Cade Cavalli, takes his helmet, chucks it in Cavalli's direction, and it gets pretty messy. So that is what happened as far as like what we saw on the broadcast. Like, if you were watching this game live, that is how you took this in the moment. But there are a couple other crucial pieces of context that I will share now. One is that Wilson Contreras is dealing with quite a bit right now. The earthquake tragedy that is going on in Venezuela has hit a lot of Venezuelan baseball players very hard. It has hit Wilson Contreras very hard. We have seen him be emotional outwardly over the last couple of days, crying in the dugout after hitting a home run. He and some of his Red Sox teammates are outside the stadium trying to raise money for relief. And I do think that that context is important, just because if we're talking about someone making a volatile decision, their emotional state and mindset in that moment, I do think is particularly relevant. Also relevant, and this falls into our belief that multiple things can be true, Contreras does have a reputation around the league as, one player said to me, a tired act, right? He is frisky and feisty and willing to chirp in a way that I think goes beyond the norm. And I think that both of those pieces of context are important here. So I'll kick it to you, but I think that is kind of the base level of where we're at going into yesterday's fracas.
Yeah, and I guess a couple of things to mention. Contreras was also ejected on Monday. Now, that was an interaction with the umpire where Contreras was essentially, I guess on the way back from the dugout, was tapping his helmet as if to almost challenge, quote-unquote, after the fact. Now, this is a situation where he was ejected very quickly. Chad Tracy was very upset about this. The umpire, after the fact, I think it was Nick Lentz, in the pool report was like, well, yeah, you can't do that. That is very explicitly in the rules of
this
ABS world.
We were all over this.
Yeah, we said this was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. If you strike out and you don't challenge, you cannot top your head as like a, oh, you messed up. Like, I believe this happened in like spring training when they were onboarding it.
Yes.
This is the baseball version of covering your mouth. Okay. Just don't do it. It's an automatic red. Automatic red card for Wilson Contreras, okay? And
right.
So that is also important because, like, he enters the game on Tuesday in the, like, not in a good place, right?
But I'm also mentioning that because while I do, not that I want to see players ejected even for stuff like this, and I think this was a case because of everything that Contreras is dealing with, that Chad Tracy and the Red Sox were like, dude, like, give this guy, like, have some feel towards the umpire of, like, where this guy is at. And it's not necessarily anything aggressive towards
give
the ump.
Give him some flex.
The ump is just, you know, he is enforcing a rule that is very clear in the rule book now about how ABS is functioning and what players can and can't do involving this. So you could kind of see the gray area there from both sides. But I do think that that's also important context. You mentioned Contreras' reputation that has obviously followed him throughout his career. That has been, as you mentioned, in some respects well-earned, that he's been willing to kind of talk his stuff. But as we acknowledge here, and we can get back to the details, he was not the first person to talk in this case. Now, I do think that before we get to what Cavalli said, we can also talk about what happened earlier in this game, which we have not mentioned yet, as well, between Contreras and Cavalli. So you can give that background as well.
Yeah, I think it was just after the first or second inning, Contreras is on base. Cavalli's walking by to the dugout. Contreras walks by or like jogs by and basically cuts Cavalli off, like with his head down, almost runs into him. Like, if neither of these guys were looking, like, they would have just clanged into each other. I'm kind of surprised that this doesn't happen more often, but I do think it is indicative that it doesn't ever happen. This is something that definitely did tick off Cavalli. You could see he was talking about it after the game. Chad Tracy, Red Sox manager, said that Contreras didn't mean to do it, and he, like, tried to apologize. That is an important piece of context here because I do think it added to the level of, you know, zest within Cade Cavalli that made him want to go at Wilson Contreras. I also think that Contreras, like, I'm not going to use the word showboat. Like, he enjoyed his own home run on Monday, the one after which he cried, but like he flipped his bat, like, and which as he should, you know what I mean? And like, I think that's fine. Like, we obviously have no problem with that. Fast forward to the fourth inning, Cavalli punches him out looking and then chirps, quote, sit down, boy, at Contreras. I don't really have a problem with chirps from pitchers. Like, if you're going to allow hitters to go nuts, then I think that this is in a way the pitcher version of that because they can't like flip their glove. However, sit down, boy, is not something that I think should be in Cade Cavalli's vocab, right? He went to that a little easy. Now the context there is, I think that Wilson Contreras heard sit down, boy, and like understood like the racial implication of that? I don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. when they zoom in to Contreras, he's like saying, what did you say to me? What did you say to me? And again, this is the multiple things could be true. Like, Cavalli was clearly feeling himself here. Like, he was, he's one of the, probably the best start of his life, of his career. I mean, struck out 13, absolutely. Went seven. Like, like, he was incredible last night. And so you can kind of see that in the way that Cavalli was moving on the mound. And like, when you're in the heat of competition, you say stuff. That being said, this is not a club that should be in his bag, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and I want to just clarify. I don't know if you misspoke or just we'll get to Naylor and Hedges. I don't, with all due respect to the media monster that John Boy has created, I'm not a big fan of the lip reading world in the modern media space. However, I will just, I think, clarify that what I saw Contreras say, which I thought was pretty clear, was, are you talking to me? Right?
Are
Why
you
are you talking to me?
Thank you. Yes.
Not what did you say, which Thank I do you. Think in this case is a specific difference. And that Contreras was, and I do think that this is another part when, to your point about what pitchers are able to do and what we think is fine with pitchers are able to do because of all the celebrations that, that hitters are able to do is, and this is a distinction that often comes up in college with what coaches feel comfortable with. Are you firing yourself up and your teammates up, or are you antagonizing the other team? And that is, I do think, a difference that goes both ways for the hitters and for the pitchers and can sometimes be a little bit cloudy. But to your point, I do mostly agree that pitchers being able to show emotion that sometimes involves some sort of verbal direction towards the hitter is both not surprising and I don't think always necessarily a bad thing. But in this case, I can understand why this is probably not something that we should be supporting. And in Wilson Contreras' case, I think he was surprised that Cade Cavalli was coming at him, as opposed to if Cade Cavalli just turns to his own dugout and is like, let's go, you know, in his face, that's one thing. But to say anything directed to the hitter specifically, as let alone what was specifically being said, I do think that there's a little bit of a difference there.
Yeah, and you could see now how Contreras in this moment is like when you put a water balloon under a faucet and it expands and then like pop, right? This was growing and the pressure was intensifying inside of him and he just lost it. Throwing the helmet is just a no. Like, that cannot happen. I was kind of disappointed by the Red Sox ability to hold him back. And that the responsibility fell down to K-Bear Ruiz, the Nationals catcher, who is Venezuelan. And I would imagine that was important. Probably knows Contreras a little bit. But when you look at like how he was able to, for lack of a better term, break containment and like return with his helmet as a weapon, like the Red Sox were not really playing defense on their own guy at the beginning of this. And I think that, yes, it's difficult to like adjudicate that in the moment. Heat of it all, I understand. But like, that is when this goes to like a next level situation. Everyone's pushing and shoving. We get four ejections: Contreras, Chad Tracy, Red Sox utilityman Nate Eaton, and Nationals pitcher Miles Michaelis. And now I would like to talk about Miles Michaelis. These two are basically doing like Greco-Roman wrestling sideshow on the side, and they both get tossed. Watching Miles Michaelis throw Nate Eaton to the ground legitimately changed the way that I think about Miles Michaelis' athleticism. Nate Eaton is one of the best athletes in the sport, like raw athletes.
Yeah.
One of the fastest players in the league, preposterously strong throwing arm. And most importantly for this context, went to the Virginia Military Institute. Like, this is probably an individual that has been trained in hand-to-hand combat to a certain extent. And for Miles Michaelis to like discard him to the turf like a sack of potatoes was legitimately impressive. Like, I know this is the highlight of Miles Michaelis' season. You got to think, right? Like, well, I was thrown by that. So I guess hats off to Miles Michaelis for getting into it. And, you know, like, it, whenever one of these things happen, you have to evaluate it both from like the normal human perspective and from the baseball player brain perspective. They are all leaving the dugout to like, quote, defend their guy. And if you don't do that, if you don't leave the dugout and you don't back up your teammates, you then have to go back into the room and like wear that. And so that's why literally everyone leaves, is benches clearing, right? And I think specifically for like this Nats team that is led by 33-year-old Blake Butera, who is like very kind, like he leads with kindness and empathy. I was maybe not encouraged, but I appreciated that the Nats showed a little bit of zest, a little bit of spunk, a little bit of oomph to them that I haven't really seen, a little bit of FU, you know, and on a coaching staff and a team full of younger dudes, I think this showed that they still have a little grit on their bones.
Yeah, I think that's a fair interpretation of the Nationals. You've certainly seen plenty of them up close. I just want to finish with a couple other things on the Red Sox before we go to Naylor and Hedges. You mentioned maybe being disappointed a little bit about the level of support that Contreras was getting in the moment. I also just think that not just the situation in Venezuela, but I mean, I've referenced it as we've talked about the season as a whole for the Red Sox. Contreras is just in a really weird spot. I mean, I think about this often for any player that kind of shows up on a new team that's expecting to win and the team sucks, but that player is still good. I mean, this is just a textbook example because he is having one of the best seasons of his career. He has been exactly what he was brought in to be. He has shown this intensity, this emotion, even before this past week on the few, you know, big homers that he's been able to give them that have actually helped them win a game, because he's the only guy really doing his job on offense in a real way. And he probably thinks that, like, who's going to tell me what to do, how to feel, how to act when I'm the only one actually performing? And so you can imagine that this has just been a difficult transition for him. I don't know what kind of relationship he had built with Alex Cora in the few months they were together before Alex Cora was fired. But I also know, and I said this when this happened, and this is nothing against Chad Tracy. Wilson Contreras, he doesn't know anything about this Chad Tracy guy who, yes, right, he's worked with Meyer and these other AAA players.
But that's the thing, is like part of the selling point on Tracy was like, oh, he knows a lot of the younger players. It's like, okay, yeah, but he doesn't know any of the older players, right? And so I think that dynamic, we do see that here a little bit. But like at the end of the day, man, like Wilson Contreras, I'm not like saying he needs help, but like this guy, I think, could take a day. And I think he'll, you know, I'm sure there'll be suspensions handed out today. And I know the Red Sox are trying to fight their way back into this, and they've been playing better and they want their best bat in the lineup. But it's like, we're now at a point where, you know, take a day, like free yourself.
Yeah.
It's more important than going out there and competing. And I do think that that is part of this conversation. Like the point where I was like, okay, what is Contreras, while the game is still going on, responding to people on Instagram? Like, come meet me at Fenway. Like, let's fight. Like,
yeah.
That, like, you just can't do that. Like, no matter the content, you just can't be doing that. And, like, the comparisons to Pablo Sandoval scrolling Instagram on the toilet like a decade ago when he was on the Red Sox. Like, yes, that's a little funny, whatever. Just, there's just a line. And I think that Contreras crossed it. Understanding why that happened is important and crucial in terms of like how we make sure that he stops doing this, right? Like, or how he goes back to like being all right. Now, I think he's always going to have some edge to him. And I think that that's a good thing for certain players. And I think that just because you're on another team and you think he's a tired act doesn't mean that the tired act isn't working for the guys that are on his team. As we pivot to Josh Naylor, who is very much this. Josh Naylor and Austin Hedges got into it over the weekend. These two played together in Cleveland for a long time. They played together in San Diego back in the day. They actually came over to Cleveland together, which is a thing that I had kind of forgotten about. Josh Naylor now on the Mariners after a little bit of time in Arizona. And just to simplify this, the thing that went viral is Hedges saying, nobody likes you, your own teammates don't even like you. I'm paraphrasing maybe a little bit, but that is kind of how this went to the next level. Naylor is a pest. I do not say that in a negative sense. I say that in the hockey terminology. He gets into people's heads. He gets under people's skin. He is irritable and irritating. And I think that that can be an inspiration if you're on his team. And I think if you're not on his team, it makes him dartboard fodder. So how do you, as someone that has spent a good amount of time in Cleveland, kind of view this falling apart between two former teammates?
Yeah, so I would first point to, well, let me also just provide one little additional thing of context if you didn't see any of this. Hedges in this game did not just randomly yell this at him. This seemed to be a response to two things that seemed to happen in short sequence of each other. I was not at the ballpark for this stuff, so this was not a firsthand account, just to clarify. But
Jordan was walking around the streets of Cleveland screaming, "Nobody likes you, not even your friends like you," to anybody who'd listen. You were just...
That's true. That's true.
Being
mean
to
strangers. But I did miss this specific case. Josh Naylor was hit by a pitch. It looked very much like he leaned into the pitch. And Josh Naylor was also... that's obviously at any level of baseball, when it seems like someone leans into the pitch, the team who has thrown the hit by pitch is not happy about that. So that's where the chirping begins. And Josh Naylor allegedly was also yelling things at Austin Hedges that were insulting and derogatory about Austin Hedges' qualities as a baseball player. Now, the larger context, I think, is explored very well by former Barbacast guest host Zach Meisel, who, of course, covers the Guardians at The Athletic. And I think his story was really good because it zoomed a lot farther out about the Josh Naylor-Cleveland relationship and how that evolved and how it grew initially with the trade and then evolved and then deteriorated as the Guardians essentially decided, we have no interest in extending you. Josh Naylor, as he is becoming an all-star hitter and one of the most important players on the team and in the clubhouse, was very hurt by that. And that resulted in a very icy relationship between him and the front office that ultimately led to him being traded to Arizona. This is also going on while his own brother, who is also on the team, Bo Naylor, his career goes in a few different directions. And then after Josh Naylor leaves or is traded, Bo Naylor's career has since ended up in a delicate position, which also involves Austin Hedges, uncoincidentally, and who the Guardians are committing to as a catcher. Long term, they trade for Patrick Bailey. That's what sends Bo Naylor to the minors. Now, how much of any of this has to do with Josh Naylor sticking up for his brother and feeling like Bo needs to get out of there? Who knows? The Josh and Bo relationship has always also been a little bit interesting and not necessarily what you would always expect, even when they were together in Cleveland. I can just say that, seeing it up close. Not to say that they don't have a good relationship, but this was not always a situation where it was like these guys were always together and always talking to each other and always hanging out. Like, they were on the same team for a few years, but Josh is, as we have learned, and not just in this, but in other Naylor-related things that have surfaced recently that we can reference, Josh is a complicated individual, and he's someone that, along his many stops in baseball, has felt like he has not been respected. And I do think that this was something that was talked about when he first got to Seattle last year, when it was not pretty between him in Arizona, it was whatever. But before that, and when he came back to Cleveland last year, he just still feels a lot of he just doesn't feel good feelings towards Cleveland as successful as he was there. That does not mean he has a bad
relationship.
And he's
not the only
one. He's not the only one.
I just
think that's definitely true.
Can I just hop in on you? Like,
yeah.
This happens with teams like the Brewers and the Guardians and the Rays, where because of how they operate, where they're always flipping these guys just as they reach free agency, it does create a level of disdain once those players leave. And it also does create a level of unease for the players that are then still there, because it's like, okay, I'm next, right? And I understand why, but the distinction there is important. Like, it's not the people, it's the system, right? Like, Naylor does not have ill will, I'd imagine, towards Stephen Vogt, Guardians manager. Right. It's ill will towards the way that the Guardians have chosen to operate.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. But yeah, I mean, they were here and I was there on Friday and Josh Naylor was happily catching up with all kinds of other Guardians staff members, right? I'm sure that there are a lot of people who work in the clubhouse, who work behind the scenes and other teammates who still have a good relationship with him. As for the specific one with Hedges, that one is a little bit harder to interpret because, again, there's a little bit of the context with his brother. There's just Austin Hedges himself is a complicated character who is beloved by his teammates and also sometimes is a little chirpy with the opponents.
Like,
so,
I would say that certain people would call Austin Hedges a tired act, you know, harkening back to our conversation about Contreras. And like, I don't, that's not for like me to necessarily adjudicate whether that is the case with Contreras. I want to be clear. Like, I am not calling anybody a tired act. I am saying that there are people in the business that see these guys as such. Same thing with Naylor, where it's like, all right, we get it. Like, you're passionate, you're fiery. Okay, Austin Hedges, we get it. Like, you're a goofball. Like, but when you're in the room with these people, like, you've that context doesn't matter because you're just trying to win baseball games, and these guys help break up the monotony of 162. I think that's true with Contreras. It's true with Hedges, true with Naylor. And that is like is viewed as an asset. There's a reason that someone like Tommy Pham keeps getting jobs, right? Because there's an element of edge that ball clubs want to have around and that certain ball clubs could probably use a little bit more of. And so where I'm left at the end of the day here with both of these things is like, this isn't good. Like, none of this is good, but like, I do think that having people in the sport that have edge, that create tension, is kind of what makes this interesting. Now, it's a little bit different between these two situations. Obviously, like, the Contreras one is like darker for multiple reasons. And I think that like that is a little bit different. But like with this Hedges Naylor one, it's like, okay, yeah, these guys don't like each other. Great. Not everyone's got to be kumbaya. And not everyone's got to hold hands all the time.
Yeah. And at the same time, I think this is why I'll just circle back to Zach's story, because I do think that there is a lot of interesting baseball related context that does lead up to these interactions. That's not just there are all kinds of players across baseball that just don't like each other because there are athletes that are prideful and don't like the cut of the other guy's jib. This is one that does actually have some interesting backstory. And I would say the other big picture thing on Naylor that I'll just finish with before we take a break is, you know, I mentioned the relationship with Cleveland, but this is also informs, I think, how he has taken to Seattle. The fact that they committed to him to such a significant degree, even before he really got to free agency, traded for him, what he was able to give them in the second half, because Hedges saying nobody likes you, your own teammates don't even like you. Is Hedges referring to guys on the Mariners he knows that he thinks he's, you know, informing him, hey, these guys don't actually like you? Or is he just talking about their old Guardians teammates and that none of them actually like them? Josh Naylor traded 4 times, you know, early in his career before he ends up at a place in Seattle that wants to commit to him. And so clearly to him, loyalty and comfort and feeling like he's getting back what he's giving to the team is not something he felt at many points along his career. And so now I think in Seattle, and this is why the Mariners are also always going to be, of course, incentivized to protect him and to defend him regardless of his antics, is because they've made that commitment. And obviously so far this season, let's just be honest, he has not performed up to the level that they were hoping, but this is still someone that I think that they believe in big time. And I think that that's why you're going to see people, the Mariners, stand by him.
We all just want to be loved, baby. We all just want to be loved.
Yeah.
Let's be kind today out there in the world. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't go up to people and say nobody likes you. Okay. Jordan, I'll tell you this. Everybody likes you.
Whoa. Everybody likes Jordan. We don't have to. No. We don't have to go that far in the other direction. We don't have to lie. All right. But I don't think
anybody. Oh, listen to this. I don't think anybody dislikes you. You know.
All right. Well, we can debate that.
People dislike me. I'm more your Josh Naylor type character. You want to have me on your team, but if you're coming up against me, I'm not always, you know, everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah. Let us know. I'm good in the room. About that assessment.
Good in the room, though.
Baseball bar.
Yeah. Email us. Let us know. baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Am I a guy you want in the room?
Before we take a break, just a reminder, the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel launches on July 10th. keep an eye out for where to subscribe. We will be promoting that because that's where all of our content is going to be found, at least in video form. If you're not already watching us on YouTube, I mean, come on now. What are you waiting for? But we appreciate the support there, and we look forward to that channel being launched. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we return...
If you're not watching on YouTube, you're missing the best part of the show, which is that I have Aaron Judge, Rob Manfred teeth. I mean, that's like...
Oh, that's true. If people have never seen Jake Mintz before...
You're missing the gap, you know?
Now you go. Well, just make sure you subscribe to the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel. You'll get to see Jake Mintz's face clear as day. All right, we're going to take a break when we return. The MLB draft is coming up. Let's preview it. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. The date is July 1st. Bobby Bonilla Day, the day where the Mets pay Bobby Bonilla, one of my least favorite days in the baseball calendar, to be honest with you, because you have to explain how like the time value of money works to people that just want to dunk on the Mets. I'm not going to waste that much more energy here doing that. But the reason I bring up it's July 1st is that July for George Schusterman means one thing. It is MLB draft time. The 2026 MLB draft will take place the Saturday of All-Star, I believe that is July 7th, Brutal Jake, math. Be better than this.
It's literally that on our July screen right now.
11th.
It's almost at 10th. That was tough. That was a tough intro.
Hard to watch.
It's true. Now, I don't blame you for being a little bit confused, because the league has moved the draft around plenty, not just over the last 10 years, but also over the last year or two, as they have flip-flopped the draft and the futures game this year. So the draft will begin on Saturday. That will be the first real event of All-Star Weekend. I guess they have the HBCU Classic on Friday night. But on Saturday afternoon in Philadelphia, I believe 1 o'clock Eastern time, will be the beginning of round one. This is a 20-round draft that is now spread over 2 days. The first four rounds will take place on Saturday. So we'll be going all afternoon on Saturday. Jeez. I believe they have a very strange format. NBC is doing the broadcast for the draft this year. However, I believe that they are only broadcasting the first 10 picks. So they are going to spread out the first. Yes. This is how it is. Yeah. So, in some ways, this is good.
Get excited.
Because, it's weird. Then they're going to broadcast the, I believe, 10 through 40 on MLB Network. And then the rest will be on MLB.com for the rest of the day.
Sure. So the reason it is happening at 1 o'clock for everyone is that the World Cup will still be going on. Mm-hmm. There are semifinal games at 5 o'clock and 9 o'clock that day. And I believe that that is part of the reason why it has the afternoon slot, because definitely the same demographic of people are interested in the MLB draft and the World Cup semifinal. Jordan, but enough about the schedule. Let's get into these players, because the MLB draft is more important and more relevant than it has ever been before. And I mean that for the following reason. For much of our lives and for much of the history of the sport, it took longer for players to go from draft day to making their MLB debuts. That timeline has never been shorter. Players, when they are drafted, are getting to the big leagues quicker than ever before. Now, part of that is because there are fewer minor league levels, and part of that is because player development at the amateur levels is better than ever before. And so I think players are better generally at like hopping in and just going. Teams want to get these guys up to the big leagues as soon as possible so they can help winning at the big league level. Sure, there's a financial element of it playing into it as well. And so what that means is when the names are called on draft day, they are relevant to you and your favorite team more than they've ever been before. And I think that that dynamic is the single biggest reason why our draft carries less sauce in the national sporting consciousness than the NFL and the NBA, and maybe in some ways even the NHL draft. I would say proportionally the NHL draft is a bigger deal than the MLB draft, and that is because it takes longer. How am I, for LeBron James going first overall, this guy is going to be on the Cleveland Cavaliers in 25 minutes, right? Back in 2003 or whatever. For the number one overall pick in MLB last year, Eli Willits, he might not be in DC for three and a half years. That timeline, though, is shrinking, and that makes this all the more relevant. Jordan, what do you make of that general dynamic?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I think that the 2024 draft has done a lot of heavy lifting in this regard. Certainly what's happened with Paul Skeens, but I mentioned the 2024 draft because that was considered a very good draft, and we've talked about that plenty on this show. But Skeens was like, okay, well, he's this outlier. Let's not just like pretend like everybody can be like Paul Skeens, where you zoom to the big leagues and you're immediately one of the best pitchers in the world. These are other just really good players that particularly come out of college, and then in the 2024 case also have a generational talent like Connor Griffin, who goes a little bit later in the top 10, who also zooms to the majors. I think it's also interesting because it's what you said. It's just an easier selling point. It's to say, hey, wait a minute. Maybe this player isn't going to help my team reach the playoffs this season. Although, you know, we've seen at least a couple examples of that in recent years with pitchers. But it's just someone that you can start thinking about where they fit into your team's plans, whether it's, okay, this position, we have a free agent coming up. Well, we expect him to be there at this time next year. And now it is no longer a ridiculous thing to believe, especially when you're talking about the names at the top of the draft, especially when you're talking about guys that have succeeded in college. I think the player development point is interesting because some people would push back and be like, well, actually, these guys are not as ready to be in the majors as they have been in the past because they haven't been as well seasoned through minor league competition. But I also think that there's something that teams are saying, well, listen, there's less value in keeping these guys cooking in the minors, not just because we have less time and fewer spots and we need to rush them, but also because the only way that these talented players are going to figure out how to be good major leaguers is to be in the major leagues. And so the most extreme version of that is the Angels saying, screw it, like minor leagues don't exist. Just come to the majors and figure it out. Some of those have worked out. Some of those have not. You can debate that with the likes of Neto and Chanuel, et cetera, Christian Moore. But I think even with someone like Bazana, even with Kurtz, I mean, we barely saw him in the minor leagues. Cags, I think, is maybe a great example of this, right? To rush him to the big leagues last year, for him to fall on his face, but that was valuable learning, and now he does look like a building block that Royals fans can be excited about. Not to mention so many other guys that we saw, pitchers, of course, making that adjustment a lot faster.
Yeah.
Guys like Trey Savage. So this year in particular is a little bit different because unlike in 24, where you had this deep group of incredible college performers, 5 to 10 of them where you could really imagine going fast to the majors, that list is a little bit smaller, but there are some ones at the top that I think we can be really excited about making an impact in the majors sooner rather than later.
So top, let's just do top five draft order, I think is probably what people need to know, right? We've got, at number one, the Chicago White Sox. Number two, the Tampa Bay Rays. Number three, the Minnesota Twins. Number four, the San Francisco Giants. And at number five, the Pittsburgh Pirates. There is a very clear top three in this draft. If you look at most rankings, that is how it will be laid out. Those three players, and we will talk about them now, are UCLA shortstop Rock Chalowski, Georgia Tech catcher Von Lackey. For those of you at home, that is V-A-H-N. Not V-O-N, V-A-H-N, Lackey, and Texas high school shortstop Grady Emerson. Grady Emerson. Rock Chalowski is the most famous name. He has kind of been the top guy in this class for about a year now. He's still going to be number one on most boards, on most mock drafts. Jordan, what is the likelihood that Rock Chalowski goes number one to the White Sox, and what would make him the pick there? What is special about Chalowski?
Yeah, and I think that he's someone, I mean, not just last year or the past year, really the last 2 years, he was already a fringe first-round talent coming out of high school, son of a scout, who I think is still scouting with the Reds, I believe, Arizona high school. But he says, no, I'm going to UCLA because, you know, what's better than being a first-rounder is being the first overall pick. And what he was able to do as a Bruin, particularly his sophomore season, was just really special. And to lead them to Omaha as a sophomore. This year as a junior ends up being a little bit more disappointing. His numbers don't really take another leap forward. They are merely very good against Big Ten competition that is considered a pretty sizable step down from the likes of certainly the SEC, but even the ACC. And yet, and UCLA, who's the number one team all year, ends up flaming out in the regionals. So that's a little bit disappointing. But what this guy offers is a really incredibly just, he's good at everything. I mean, it's that simple, right? I mean, this is someone who has shown the ability to hit for average, the ability to get on base, the ability to lift the ball, which is also important. He's getting to his power. It is not something like, this is not someone that is just hitting the ball really hard into the ground, like which was a concern for someone like Dylan Cruz, yeah, who had a lot of similar profile, a lot of the similar profile going into his draft year. And he's a damn good shortstop. And when you combine all that with someone that from a makeup standpoint is pretty much exactly what you want to be signing up for in terms of just him growing up, not just necessarily around the game, like he's going through big league clubhouses, but this is someone who just changed, not that UCLA hadn't had success in the past, but they were in a low place when he sort of got there in his freshman year.
He brought
year.
Them back.
And he said,
brought them back
he
to
said,
what
listen,
what they used to be.
He said, hop on, right? Him and that junior class said, we're bringing UCLA back to glory. Sure, it was disappointing how it ended this past spring, but he's someone that he checks all the boxes of like, yes, this guy can be the face of a franchise, can handle that, yeah, can embrace that, and can just be a damn good baseball player at a really important position at shortstop.
Now, the ceiling might not be there with Chulaski. It's hard to see him being one of the best 10 players in the world. It's very easy to see him being one of the best 100 players in the world. The comp that gets thrown out there a lot is Dansby Swanson, where you have a high college shortstop with a high floor who has some of those off-the-field attributes that you're looking for. The downside with Chulaski, at least for me, is like he's not built like a typical shortstop. He's a little bit thicker in the hips, which is admittedly an odd thing to say about someone, but it is relevant when you're evaluating them as an athlete. He's a good athlete. He's not like a superb athlete. He's certainly not as good of an athlete as some of the other names at the top of this draft, like, you know, Jacob Lombard or even Von Lackey. But he is good at baseball, right? He is a good baseball player. And I think that in that is both too simple and also tells the story. Let's move on to Von Lackey now, who kind of not didn't come out of nowhere, but his journey from high school to where he is now is remarkable compared to Chulaski, who was a first-round pick out of high school. Lackey was barely a prospect, a D1 prospect coming out of high school. I mean, he did not get that many offers coming out of Georgia. He was at a Georgia area high school just outside of Atlanta, ends up at Georgia Tech, takes a big step forward his sophomore year, and then this year, his junior year, just explodes.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, well, we'll talk about Emerson in a second, but it is just an awesome contrast because Emerson and Chulaski, his high school career was not like, okay, he's clearly the best player at every stop the way that Emerson really has been, but was well known and in a way that Lackey was not whatsoever. And we've had a bunch of these guys who have been picked at the top of the draft out of college over the last few years that early in their college careers were complete non-factors. Guys like Wyatt Langford, who straight up did not play. Guys like Charlie Condon, who redshirted not because of an injury, just because he wasn't ready to play yet, right? There have been guys that have recovered is not the right word, but to basically take their time and figure it out. Now, in Von Lackey's case, really what happened here was an incredible combination of physical growth and player development growth that happened at the same time. This was not he clearly must have had some level of intriguing athleticism for Georgia Tech to give him a chance on the team as someone who was not a super top recruiter, a top prospect on the showcase circuit. At the same time, he did not have this kind of physicality and this kind of explosive ability. When he arrived on campus, he gets bigger, he gets stronger. And then even after only gets about 100 at-bats, plate appearances as a freshman, hits 214, 711 OPS. And then last year, the numbers were not crazy. They were very impressive for a sophomore catcher with that background of having barely played as a freshman and wasn't really a top guy. But when you would talk to scouts about him towards the end of last year, and then certainly once you got to the fall, even in the fall, it was like, oh yeah, no, this guy might just be the best player in the country already. Like, he is going to be in the mix. And I remember hearing that and looking at his numbers from last year and being like, that seems a little rich. Like, we got to see a lot more before I would take a guy. And that's not fair to me. It's not like I said he's going to have the exact same season. But my goodness, did he – I mean, look at these numbers. I mean, he goes from a 921 OPS as a sophomore to a 1291 as a junior, 20 homers. He steals 15 bases. He has actually throughout his college career shown cameos at literally every position besides pitcher. You see him pregame. I saw him in person against Boston College. You'll see him take infield. He looks like a natural shortstop, natural third baseman, natural second baseman. He's out shagging in the outfield. And yet this guy wants to catch. He's embraced being a catcher, and that's awesome. And when you combine that with an offensive skill set that just keeps getting better by the week, that is why you have a player that is in, I think, should be in real consideration by the White Sox. Based on my understanding, it sounds like they're closer, more deciding between Chalowski and Emerson. But man, whichever team in the top three here, or I guess if he falls any further, gets Von Lackey, I couldn't be more excited for him and for them, because I'm all in on this guy.
Just to emphasize how out of nowhere this guy came from, his perfect game grade, and this is not scientific, his perfect game grade on a scale of 1 to 10 was 7.5. Okay. My perfect game grade, me, Jake Mintz, I podcast for a living. Okay. Not a great athlete. Sufficient, better than Jordan. My perfect game grade was a 7. Okay. Both of us excellent students. Both of us excellent students. Von Lackey, who could go first overall in the draft, was a half grade higher than my bum ass. And I think that just shows you the unbelievable amount of progress that this guy has made over a very relatively short period of time.
Yeah. And the PG grades, we will always laugh about them forever. For a little bit more context for those less familiar, is a better way to think about it. Perfect Game had him ranked 192 in Georgia. Okay, not 192 in the high school class. He was the 192nd ranked player in the state of Georgia. And now here he is at the very top of the draft. So I love Von Lackey. I think that he's, because of how much better he's gotten so quickly, that's a trajectory you are excited about in a way that Chalowski, you did not see that this season. I think people thought that the season he was going to have as a junior was going to be this
unbelievable. He kind of plateaued a little bit.
He kind of plateaued, if not went a little bit backwards. It wasn't a bad season, but we were thinking, oh, this is going to be no doubt Golden Spikes. He's going to have a 1,500 OPS beating up on Big Ten pitching. That just didn't happen. But what Von Lackey did in this historic Georgia Tech lineup, I mean, that was special. So let's talk about Grady Emerson. I know he's someone that you've kind of dug in on a little bit more over the last couple of days. What has stood out about him to you?
Grady Emerson, high school shortstop from Texas, transferred for his senior season from a big public high school to a smaller Christian private school. That is coached by former big leaguer Rusty Greer. I think he wanted to kind of be in that type of environment for his senior year. He has been the best player in his class for like 4 years. He has been relatively baseball famous for a while now. He is your prototypical, does everything well high school shortstop. The raw athleticism might not be there. It is similar in that regard to last year's number one overall pick, Eli Willits, where he does a lot well and nothing at an extraordinary level. I really love this guy. I think that it is incredibly advanced. I think as he gets older, he will add more power. He will add more athleticism when he gets into a pro training program. We have seen players like this, up the middle high school athletes at the top of the draft. Like when you are special, when you are like you can separate yourself, when you are like described as a guy who hits, right? That's the thing with Emerson. Like people believe in this bat. Mm-hmm. I think the sky's the limit here. I'm very in on Grady Emerson.
Yeah, and there are certainly some teams that also view it as kind of obvious that he is the best player in the class just because of what he's been so consistently the whole time, that you project him to be a good shortstop, a left-handed hitter who's going to grow into more power, that's done it, you know, on the showcase circuit against the best competition. So yeah, that's why he's kind of separated himself and really held serve at the top there. And I think the simplest way to put it is that while it is not clear what order these three will go in, at this point, it would be basically shocking if this is not the top three picks in some order. I think that is the best way to put it. So Well, if you tune in on Saturday, I can't say for. And by the way, you're going to see mock drafts over the next week that see these percentages for Chalowski 1, Emerson 1, Lackey 1. Like, those are going to go up and down just because this is just how this works. That said, I do expect these three to be the three picks, the three top picks, which puts the San Francisco Giants in an interesting spot. And I think they're a team I'm interested in this draft for other reasons that we can get to. But I will say, if there is one other player I do want to mention, it is Jackson Flora, who's the top pitcher, right-handed pitcher from UC Santa Barbara. Because frankly, the more I dig into this and the more I've looked at Jacob Lombard and Eric Booth Jr., who are the next two high school guys and also very likely to be in the mix in the top seven, Drew Burris, a very interesting Georgia Tech outfielder that I'm excited to talk more about as we get closer to the draft, maybe on draft day. I think Jackson Flora is a clear number four. I think that he's maybe not a generational top pitcher on the Skeens level, this was reinforced even more after talking to him at the combine. This is a dude that really gets it, and is you love to talk to the players that, especially ones like him and Von Lackey, who. And I've never interviewed Von Lackey, but the ones who weren't necessarily always told, okay, yeah, you're obviously going to be a first-round pick. This is what you're working towards. And this is no offense to Emerson or Rock Chalowski, who have been thinking about Saturday, July 11th for a long time because that was always the plan. The guys that really came into their own and like embraced the opportunity that their physical gifts started to give them and to be like, I am going to make the most of this. I am so excited that I have this physical talent. I'm going to figure out how to really be, in his case this year, arguably the best pitcher in college baseball and a top pitching prospect. So there's a lot of things that are going to go into the Giants draft. But if those top three are off the board, if I'm them, I'm taking Jackson Flora. I think, especially for a team that really needs pitching in their farm system, they need a lot of things right now. But regardless of how we think about Booth and Lombard, which is a longer conversation for another day, I just love what Flora offers in terms of floor and ceiling. And talking to him, I was even more convinced by that this is the kind of pitcher that's going to go get it and go make the most of and really take advantage of the tools in front of him. So I'm excited about this guy, and I wouldn't be surprised if he goes fourth. I think that would be well deserved. And if he falls farther than that behind some of the bats, I think some team's going to be really lucky.
We could go on for another hour talking about draft prospects. I do want to wrap it up because, you know, people have things to do. Any final thoughts as we hurtle towards what is one of your favorite days of the year?
Yeah, I mean, I'll have my top 50 coming out early next week. I'm working on that. That will be, of course, informed by my own rankings and my own preferences, but also who I think is going to go in the first 50 picks. I want it to serve as also kind of a what to expect on draft day, whose names will be called first. And yeah, I think that the last thing just think about just beyond the players is some of those teams that have really interesting draft opportunities. Teams like the Giants, who have a really big bonus pool, getting lucked out in the lottery, picking up all the way going up to number four. The fact that they traded for a comp pick from the Guardians and the Patrick Bailey trade, they have a big bonus pool. The Astros have a huge bonus pool for the first time in years and years and years after having picks taken away for the sign stealing scandal and also just picking late in the first round. The Braves have a huge bonus pool because they have the extra pick from Drake Baldwin winning Rookie of the Year and the fact that they sucked last year. So there are some teams that have bigger bonus pools than they've had in years. What they do with those opportunities is definitely a storyline I'm going to be watching next week. But we will take a break here. Again, plenty more draft content coming on Yahoo Sports on the podcast. Of course, I'll be writing plenty about it in the coming weeks. But we'll take a break for now. When we return, a quick around the league before we say goodbye.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the league before we get you out of here. I have professed a zero craps given in regards to the makeup of the Major League Baseball, the baseball itself, not the league. That is an important distinction. We did get confirmation that the ball is different this year. MLB, he admitted. You know, Saris posted something about how the drag on the baseball is down. This is all very science-y and physics and ball flight and whatever. The upshot here is that like the league did admit that there is like something different with the balls, and it's like part of the production process where there was like an imperfection. here's where I'm at on this. And the reason why I don't want to get stuck on this, is it weird that the balls are different year to year? Yes. Would we ever have noticed any of this if not for modern technology? No. I think that this is not, as people long believed, like an intentional act on behalf of MLB. Like, this is not nefarious. They are not trying to get certain balls into certain places. I think like these pills, these little spheres of joy, are moving at such a speed and at such a spin these days that we see the effects more than in any other sport because of the size and the speed. Does that make sense? Like, oh, the basketball is a little different. Well, yeah, but like it's bigger, right? You see what I'm saying? Like it's less affected by the air. If this is scientifically flawed, please email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Let me know why I should get more fired up about this. Like, I want to be there with you. I just want to watch the guys play the baseball, regardless of what the baseball is.
Yeah, I mean, my main pushback would be, you said, oh, well, we would notice this if we didn't have the technology. I think in 2019, we would have been like, something's weird. We are not at 2019 was too levels. Much.
I think we agree. Yeah. I think we've all, yes. Let me add that caveat. 2019 was bananas and too far, and like those balls were juiced. And MLB said, oh, this is too much. Whatever is happening here, we need to fix it. And they fixed it. And it's fine. I don't think that like the ball right now is creating like unentertaining or suboptimal play on the field. And I think that as long as that's the case, they could play with something made out of tissue paper. I don't care. As long as we stay within the boundary. So that's it. I'm off my soapbox. And I'll kick it to you to talk about June Swoon with Boone.
Well, I'm going to kick it back to you here in a second because I want your perspective on this. The Yankees lost their sixth in a row last night to finish out a miserable June in which they went 12-14. 12-14. Oh. Okay.
Disastrous.
Okay, 12-14. All right. Just hold that. Just hold that number there. Hold that record there in a second. It was a bad night for Cam Schlittler. Cam Schlittler allowed four home runs. Tarek Skubal did not allow four home runs. And so the Tigers won. This was particularly frustrating because the Yankees are back at home and they're not at Fenway getting whooped on the road. They're at home getting embarrassed by a Tigers team that has been embarrassing themselves for much of this season. That has dropped the Yankees to 48-37 on the season. Their lead atop the AL East is no more. They are, in fact, 2.5 games back as the Tampa Bay Rays have mirrored the L6 from the Yankees with a W6 of their own. Junior Caminero, fifth straight game with a home run. But let's talk about June Swoon, as Jake puts up. Again, if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see 12-14. 12-14 in the month of June. June Swoon is something you're seeing Yankees fans talk about. They say, oh, here they go again. Oh, those Yankees, they just can't get out of their own way when it comes to June. June is just miserable. Every year we get to June and we suck. We're the worst team of all time. And we say that, oh, look how bad they've been in June. And then you look and you say, okay, 12-14 this year, 13-14 last year, 14-13 in 24, 11-12 in 2023. You know what they were in 2022, Jake Mintz, in June?
No, I don't.
22-6.
That's a boon. That ain't no swoon.
June boon. June balloon. Listen, this is a great case of Yankees exceptionalism. That's what I'm going to call it. These fans, these players, this organization do not know what it means to actually suck at baseball for an extended period of time. And that is to credit. This is what the Yankees deserve more credit for than anything else they have accomplished since they last won the World Series. And as frustrating as it is, that is the standard that you hold and why it is sad that you have not won a World Series. Sad is not the right word for most people. Disappointing, frustrating that you have not won a World Series since 2009. When they talk about the way they talk about it, and yes, the 6-game losing streak is bad. Yes, the Yankees don't look like they're playing well right now. They're very injured. They have things that are going wrong. Their bullpen's not actually that good. And yet, it's like, it's so funny. Every other team, except I guess the Dodgers, but even like, okay, for example, the Braves. Maybe I'm going to be proven wrong here, and I'll sound stupid. But I want to throw it back to you.
I think they had a Jooner Swooner.
I'll confirm this in a second. I do want to throw this back to you as someone who covered the Yankees up close for the last several years during this. How much, like, is this something that was talked about that you remember experiencing? Did it feel worse in the moment? We know the Yankees have looked like a very bad baseball team for extended periods of time, but they're always playing more good baseball than bad baseball in the regular season. That is a fact that has been true forever. And so it is always hard for me to wake up and be like, oh no, oh, it's all over. It's like, guys, 12-14. Come on. It's not that bad.
It's the 24-hour media news cyclification of sports fandom, where everyone wants to be outraged, frustrated, peeved, irked, whatever, because that does more numbies than saying, hey, yeah, team's pretty good. Yeah, I think the season's long and they'll be all right. And so, like, when anything ever, any small thing goes wrong, it's like, is this the end of the Yankees as we know it? It's like, no. And, like, I'm not saying fans don't have a reason to be frustrated. Like,
sure.
Cam Schlittler getting cranked last night was unfortunate. But it is no different than anything that's happening in the 29 other places. In fact, it's happening way less. It is happening, like, on the main, way less to the Yankees than it is to any other team. But you are right that the June Swoon is more just like they're just playing all right, you know. You're just playing okay.
And but here's where I'll correct myself at least a little bit. But why I am just leaning into, because everyone's saying June Swoon. The Yankees have lost 9 of their last 11 games. Okay, that's bad.
That's a swoon.
That's bad.
That's a real swoon.
That's bad. That's bad. They also won 9 of their first 12. In June?
June balloon.
Were we saying June swoon on June 17th? No. So is it a second half June thing? Is it like, what are we?
Late June.
We just need
swoon
to work on our branding.
So late June.
We should work on our branding. But by the way, for the record, Braves 9-14 in June. So they've also played fewer games for whatever reason. They have also backloaded their terrible play because they also won 5 of their first 6 in June. So, but it's just because it rhymes, right? It really is that simple. You know, if they say
this boon June swoon has really ruined my June. Okay. Enough rhyming. I feel like I'm writing an episode of BoJack Horseman. Junior Caminero is in the Derby. That is awesome.
Hell yeah, brother.
On our list. He was so entertaining last time out. He almost won. People forget. Cal Raleigh won. Junior Caminero almost won.
I don't forget.
And he'll get a chance.
I don't forget.
To do it in Philly. This guy is a star. He is a star, a real, real star. And for him to want the spotlight, I think is indicative to me. Like, him being in this early tells me that this is important to him because of, you know, he plays in Tampa. The cameras aren't always on him. There's kind of like a dearth of healthy top flight, no doubt, megastars in the AL for this particular All-Star game. I think there's a chance we look back on this as the Junior Caminero All-Star game. I'll plant my flag in that right now.
I mean, I said it. I didn't know if we would see him again. I knew he was going to do it again someday. After what happened last year, it was clear. He was like, I will come win this event at some point. And I love that he's the first one. And like, yeah, no, I've been thinking about this. Like, I need to get back
stuck
out
in
there.
His craw.
And I need to win this thing. So we'll see who his competition is. But honestly, man, I might just be picking this guy no matter who's in the Derby. Because he is going to be
right
as
now.
Driven as almost. I know we'll have the Philly guys and whatever. But and maybe Kurtz, right? We'll see how this field shakes out, but I can imagine once we get to picking that, I might just be like, yeah, it's obviously going to be Junior Caminero.
What's the Junior Caminero connection to Philly? Is he like a big Flyers fan? Who could say? All right, that's our episode. Rangers on a W6.
Yeah,
we'll
done.
Make fun of Cooper Engle on Friday. You can email us. You can always email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. I've said this before. I'll say it again. I want to be better at connecting with you beautiful people. All right, this show is a two-way street. Maybe, and you fill our hearts when you email us, when we see something related to Pedro Martinez, who I will talk about on Friday, I promise. He has been tweeting Justin Wroblewski is the shark. Who knows why? You know why. The beautiful listeners know why. And for that, we really thank you. Thank you to Birthday Boy producer Andrew Hart, who is no longer ARB eligible, getting up there in years. He'll be at the Yankee game today, melting in the sun. So we wish him a very happy birthday. And that's it, Jordan. Anything else?
No. Thank you to Hartz, our favorite producer. Thank you to Stone Rochelle for waking up early and producing as well. And we'll be back on Friday talking all things Ugla. See you then.
Google, big taste.